G'day and welcome to Growing Stronger. I'm Tanya Chapman, a solicitor with the Elder Law Team at Catherine Henry Lawyers in Newcastle. With me today is Teresa Soames to discuss a case that falls directly within her area of expertise, a granny flat case, as they are publicly known, or more correctly referred to as an asset for care arrangement. Teresa is an associate lecturer at Macquarie Law School. She has previously taught at universities in Australia and the UK. She is currently undertaking her PhD through the University of South Australia, examining the legal position of older people in asset for care arrangements, or what you may know as granny flat arrangements. Her thesis highlights the limitations of the present law and makes recommendation for law reform in this area. So who could be more perfect to join us to discuss a case of granny flat gone wrong? Before we dive in, we're going to get to know Teresa better with some short questions called three quick questions. Question number one, what do you do to relax?
Hi Tanya, and thanks for having me here today. What do I do to relax? I really love baking, but clearly I have to balance that with some exercise, so I tend to walk my two Labradors, Bella and Gracie.
Number two, what can't you live without?
I can't live without my dogs, obviously my husband and children, but also the Australian bushland. I'm surrounded by it where I live and it's peaceful and beautiful.
Number three, what legal terms do you hate slash love?
I can't think of any legal terms that I hate, but I do really like the imagery and drama of a lot of equitable concepts and maxims, so things like intermingling streams and having to come to equity with clean hands.
Very good choices. Too much to get into now, but intermingling streams deals with the separation of laws relating to equity from other areas of law. And there's a rather nice quote of Ashburner from 1902. The two streams of jurisdiction, though they run in the same channel, run side by side and do not mingle their waters. Coming to equity with clean hands, also a very awesome principle, and it basically means that the party coming to the court, seeking for the court to recognise their rights under equity, should come to the court with clean hands, meaning they're looking for the court to right a wrong so they can't come having done wrong themselves. Basically, the principle that the court is not going to assist someone who themselves has engaged in inequitable behaviour, such as fraud, deceit, unconscionability, or bad faith. So yes, two very good terms. And number four, a special question just for you. Do you hate the term granny flat as much as I do?
Yes, I do absolutely hate the term granny flat. It has ageist connotations. It plays into stereotypes that are misleading and unhelpful.
I've mentioned this before, but I don't like the term granny flat. I believe it is insulting and incorrect. Not all older people are grandparents, and not all asset for care arrangements are with women. But I feel like I have to use the term, otherwise people won't understand what I'm referring to. The case we're looking at for this episode is a New South Wales case, so what we're discussing today will be based on the law in New South Wales, and it's not intended to be taken to be applied Australia-wide. Also, while this podcast is aimed to be informative, it is not intended to be a substitute for legal advice. For any matter or case we discuss, we summarise, skip over parts that may be too technical or boring, and we generalise. You should still see a solicitor for complete advice that relates directly to your particular situation.
Okay, give us all the facts.
Mrs. Ricky Spink has three children. There is Denise, Troy and Diane. This case involves the daughter Diane and her husband Mario Floranzo. There's a bit of history here that we need to mention, but I'll keep it as brief as I can. Ricky owned her own home in Anzac Avenue and lived there by herself. She'd also purchased an investment property with her son Troy. The investment property was at Railway Parade Engadine and was owned 30% by Ricky and 70% by Troy. They had a joint mortgage and were paying it off one-third Ricky and two-thirds Troy. In 2007, Diane and Mario and their two children moved in to live with Ricky for about a year at Anzac Avenue. During that time, Diane and Mario didn't pay any rent. It appears that they all got on well and had no problems living together. In February 2008, Diane and Mario purchased a house in Moorbank and moved there with their children. Later that year, Ricky sold her Anzac Avenue property and moved into the investment property she owned with her son. She used most of the $460,000 from the sale of her house to pay off the loan for the investment property. So even though the property was owned 30% Ricky and 70% Troy, Ricky had definitely contributed more. In 2009, Ricky gave her son $100,000 to help him purchase a mechanics business. This was a loan that Troy was expected to repay. In 2010, Diane and Mario had their third child, a boy with significant health problems. Diane was suffering health problems herself, including depression. Ricky would make frequent trips from Engadine to Moorbank, a one-hour round trip, to help care for Diane and the children. She was making this trip up to three times a week.
From June 2012, Ricky, her daughter Diane, and son-in-law Mario started throwing about the idea of buying a house together and living together. They'd all lived together before and it had worked out fine, so why not do it again? After all, Ricky was travelling to Moorbank all the time to help Diane look after the children. Wouldn't it be easier if she lived with them? And then as she got older, Diane would help look after her mum. Also, they needed a bigger house anyway, now that they had three children. The discussions took place gradually over time and in various locations, the usual back and forth you get when you're just throwing about ideas. And nothing that was said was ever written down. After looking at some properties, Diane, Mario and Ricky liked the look of a property in Casula. Diane and Mario told Ricky they would need $60,000 to pay the deposit and suggested that she borrow the money from her friends. She wasn't too thrilled with the idea of begging money off her friends, but she did end up borrowing the $60,000 from a friend and her sister-in-law. In November 2012, Diane and Mario completed the purchase of the new property at Casula. They purchased the property for $462,000 and got a bank loan for about $370,000. They also had a gift of $70,000 from Mario's parents. Also around that time, the Railway Parade property was sold. Even though the property was sold for $460,000 and Troy was on the title for 70%, they agreed he would only get $25,000 of the sale price and that would be treated as a reduction of the loan for the money Ricky had lent him to buy the business. Troy was happy with this as his mother had repaid most of the mortgage on the property. When Ricky got the money from the sale of her own property, she paid $147,000 to Diane and Mario. She also paid a further $18,314 for the renovations to be done to the property. Diane, Mario and their three children moved into the Casula property and Ricky moved into the property soon after, in January 2013. However, over time the relationship between the parties soured and within 3 years, by January 2016, they were no longer speaking to one another. Diane and Mario asked Ricky to leave and she moved out in October 2016. So let's just pause here and assess what the position of each party is. Ricky has contributed a substantial amount of money towards the purchase and renovation of a property. Because she and her daughter no longer get on, she can no longer live there. Her daughter Diane and husband Mario are the legal owners of that property. Ricky has no legal title at all. She wants her money back so she can start over. The question is, does Ricky have any claim in the property? And do Diane and Mario have to repay the money?
Silence. Court is now in session.
At the time of the hearing, Ricky was dependent upon the pension and the goodwill of friends and acquaintances for accommodation. She was on a waiting list for public housing. This is perhaps the biggest risk with asset for care arrangements. The older person is often handing over all of their money or their home, with only a promise of accommodation for the rest of their lives. When this falls through, it can lead the older person to be homeless or reliant on others for their accommodation. It is sad because the parties never think it will get that bad. At the start, there is only trust and love. How do you even consider that your child may kick you out? I always recommend that anyone doing an asset for care arrangement needs to get the agreement in writing, and the agreement should include terms that provide for all of the different ways in which the arrangement could end. I make this recommendation knowing that it is not a fun conversation to have, and it involves discussing events you can't even contemplate happening, but it needs to be done.
To quote Justice Robb, the concept of parties buying a house together is inherently ambiguous. It can mean that the parties intend to own the property together. It can also mean that the parties will, in a practical way, live together in the one house without dealing with formal ownership. If there isn't a written record, we only have the parties' different versions of what they say was discussed and agreed.
Ricky's version. First, let's look at what Ricky said the arrangement was. In her affidavit, Ricky explains how the whole asset for care arrangement came about. I won't read the whole thing, I'll just quote some extracts. Quote, Mario was the person to bring it up. He said words to the effect of, we should buy a place together. It'll be easier for you to help Diane with the kids, and you will not be living on your own. We want to buy a bigger place, big enough for all of us to live in. You can sell Engadine and put in $100,000 to buy a new place that is big enough for all of us to live in. I did not jump in hook, line and sinker at the beginning. I remember Denise said it would be a silly thing to do. Denise and Troy did not approve of the idea. I said, okay, as long as there is a separate area for me. I need a separate one-bedroom unit with my own kitchen, lounge, laundry and bathroom. I thought this would be a forever house, so I wanted to make sure it was a house I was happy with. Ricky said to her daughter Diane, if anything happens to me, my share of the property will go half to you and half to Denise. Diane agreed. We never talked about what would happen if Diane and Mario had trouble paying their loan. I never thought to talk with them about what would happen if someone changed their mind and wanted to move to a different house. In my mind, it was for life, so I did not think about that. End quote. Ricky also said that she had an agreement with Diane that when Ricky died, Diane would pay Denise her share, which would be half the money that Ricky had contributed to the purchase and renovation of the Casula property. I know I'm going to be complaining about a lot in this case, but this part as well. Just don't do this. Asking one child to promise to give money to another child. Firstly, it's not legally binding, so they don't have to do it if they don't want to, or if they have lost capacity to do it. Secondly, this could have unforeseen repercussions for the child who is supposed to give the money. For example, it could breach Centrelink gifting rules and prevent them from getting their full pension entitlement.
Now let's look at Diane and Mario's version. Diane had said that they had never committed to it being Ricky's forever home, to it being a long-term arrangement. She said she was happy for her mother to live with them. She never had a problem with the idea of a long-term occupation by her mother, but she'd always understood that Ricky could stay there for as long as Diane herself allowed her to. For Mario's version, I'll just quote some of the extracts from his affidavit. Mario said, we're going to buy a place. We need a bigger house. My parents are going to help us out by giving us some money. We want you to live with us as we take care of our own. You will get to be with your grandchildren and your daughter, and by living with us, you will always have someone to look after you, which will be good, given you've had a couple of falls and hurt yourself. Ricky then responded, I'll be putting the railway parade unit up for sale and want you to give you guys some money. Mario responded, that's not my business, it's between you and your daughter. Mario then said that Ricky replied, take it, this will be your inheritance. I've always helped, turning to Troy, I've given Troy enough help with his business. I've helped Troy out by giving him an amount of money, and I want to help you as well. Whatever is left over, I will leave for Denise. Mario then said, at paragraph 108, that Mrs. Spink never spoke to him about being a long-term thing, and nor did they talk about the property being a forever house.
That's one thing I agree with Mario on. I don't believe that anyone ever used the phrase forever home. Who uses that phrase? However, I've seen it mentioned in several asset for care cases, and I can understand what they mean, and I believe words were used to that effect. I just don't think anyone actually said, quote, forever home, end quote. Legal arguments. Let's look at the legal arguments the parties made in court. First, we have the presumption of advancement. Diane and Mario argued that the presumption of advancement applied in this case. We've discussed this in previous episodes, so I'll give the most basic summary. There is a presumption in law that if a parent transfers money or property to a child, it is a gift. It is up to the parent to prove that it was not a gift. One of the rationales for this presumption is the obligation of a parent to look after and care for children, even adult children, recognizing that it is a lifetime relationship. Diane and Mario tried to argue that this applied. This was shot down, however, for a very simple reason. Ricky's money was handed over to both Diane and Mario. Mario was not Ricky's child. He was her son-in-law, so the presumption didn't apply to him. The court said it would be inconsistent to find that the presumption somehow applied to Diane, but not to Mario, when they both received the funds. Number 2, bank loan.
Now, concerning the bank loan, one source of evidence in this case was the documents relating to the bank loan that Diane and Mario had received to help purchase the Casula property. There were internal bank memos that noted Ricky Spink would be providing funds for the purchase of the property. The bank officer they'd spoken with gave evidence. Her evidence included that Diane and Mario had told her that Ricky was giving them $150,000 and would live with them. In calculating how much the couple could borrow, the bank included the $150,000 as a gift. Ricky had also signed a statutory declaration, which is a sworn statement, for the bank. She was asked to write in the statement that the money was a non-refundable gift. Those weren't the words that she used. Instead, her statement said, "I will be providing $60,000 to Mario and Diane Florenzo. This is to help with the purchase of the property."
You might have noticed that the statement was not for the full amount that Ricky contributed. The bank notes show that it was always intended that Ricky would contribute $150,000 to the purchase. However, it wasn't all paid at once, and this statement referred to the first lump sum that Ricky provided. It actually helped Ricky's case that she hadn't used the wording that the bank asked for. She hadn't used the words "I give" or "non-refundable gift." And she was lucky that the bank officer didn't pick up on this or demand that she change it. This is a fairly common bank request. Where another person is contributing funds, it is usual for the bank to get them to sign a statutory declaration or a stat deck saying that it is a gift. The reason is that the bank has a claim on the property for payment of the home loan and associated fees. They don't want someone else to have a competing claim on the property. So if someone else is paying money towards the purchase of the property, but they won't be on the title to the property, they might have an equitable interest. So the bank will get them to waive their interest by signing a stat deck saying that their contribution was a gift. While it is a commonplace practice, I have also had a client sign it and say, "We're just signing it so they can get the money from the bank. They know they have to pay me back." That is the level of trust that is involved in these arrangements, that a party will sign a document stating the exact opposite of what they have agreed, because they trust their child to do right by them, regardless of any written documents. Legal title.
Now, with respect to the legal title, at the core of this problem is that Ricky was not on the legal title to the property despite contributing funds to the purchase. Diane and Mario argued that Ricky wasn't on the legal title because the money had always been intended as a gift. They pointed to the fact that when Troy and Ricky had purchased an investment property together, she had been on the title for 30% ownership. If she did it then, why wouldn't she have done it again this time? If this really wasn't a gift, why didn't she insist on being on the title here as well? Ricky explained this by saying that with the investment property, she was also a party to the bank loan, so she had to be on the title for the property. This makes sense. Banks prefer to loan money to the people who legally own the house. That way, if they stop paying the mortgage, the bank can take the house as security. When the Cazula property was being purchased, only Diane and Mario were on the mortgage, and Ricky didn't think to ask to be on the title as well. During cross-examination, she said, "In hindsight, had I known what was going to happen, it probably would have been a good idea to do that."
Ricky's credibility. Where you need to determine what oral agreement parties have made years ago, and it is one person's version of events versus the other person's, the credibility of the parties can play a strong part in determining who is telling the truth and ultimately the outcome of the case. In this case, Diane and Mario challenged Ricky's credibility and tried to demonstrate that her evidence couldn't be believed because she wasn't a reliable witness. To start with, they referred to the statutory declaration she had signed for the bank, which she was now saying didn't reflect the true agreement, basically saying, "Look, she lied on the stat deck. She's just a liar. You can't believe her." Thankfully, Justice Rob found that the whole thing with the stat deck wasn't any great significance in relation to Ricky's credibility. I'm sure that there have been other people who have signed similar stat decks, knowing them to be false, because that was the only way they could get the money from the bank they needed.
They also attacked her credibility based on information she had included in an application for a car loan years earlier that was proven not to be true. I won't go into it here. I'll just say that the outcome was that while Ricky wasn't wholly discredited, it did undermine her reliability a little bit.
This also highlights how all-encompassing these disputes can be. If something may be relevant to your credibility, it can be pulled in and run through the ringer.
There's also a person's general capacity to recall events from several years prior. Ricky herself admitted that it was difficult for her to remember precisely all the relevant events. I think that's only fair. After all, we're talking about conversation and events that happened 7 years earlier. However, the judge did note that Ricky was naturally extremely upset about being evicted from the house, and she had had considerable time to dwell upon the events since they happened. They also hadn't jotted down any notes nor sent any emails about the arrangements at the time that could be used to jog her memory now. The judge had concerns about the evidence given by all the parties and had to consider them all with caution.
Justice Rob also pointed out something I find interesting. Quote, "The parties discussed the proposal numerous times over a considerable period," end quote. Think about it. There may have been 30 or more different occasions where the parties discussed their plan. Maybe 5 of those conversations stand out clearly in your mind because at the time you were focused, you weren't distracted, and you thought something was important enough to store it in your memory banks. It just might also happen that the other party vividly recalls 5 conversations as well, but they remember different ones where you appear to agree with them more. You might both be recalling events correctly, just not the same ones. Justice Rob continued, quote, "It is almost certain that the proposal was put in different ways by the different parties using different words over the period, and that the proposal may have evolved in its substance and in the way that it was described by the participants. The participants were not contemplating making a clear, formal agreement that would be enforceable at law. It is likely that the participants used expressions intending those words to have a particular meaning and assuming that the others participating understood the intended meaning," end quote. Number 5, where the money went. Diane Mario also pointed to the fact that the money Ricky contributed wasn't paid directly to the person that sold them the property, or even to the conveyancer. It was paid to Diane and Mario. Mario even went so far as to say that the payment was unrelated to the acquisition of the Casula property. Justice Rob outright rejected this. The money from Ricky was needed to enable them to purchase the Casula property. Without it, they wouldn't have been able to get the bank loan and couldn't purchase it. Diane and Mario also knew that the only way Ricky could give them the money was to sell her own home. They therefore must have understood that as long as they had her money, Ricky would be unable to buy another home for herself. They then tried to argue that yes, they received the money, but not all of it was used to purchase the property. The money Ricky transferred to Diane and Mario was mixed in with their own funds. Some were used for the purchase of the property, some were used to pay for renovations, and some went to pay for just general living expenses. Diane and Mario argued that Ricky would need to trace the money to prove that money of hers actually went to the purchase of the property. However, tracing the funds was proving difficult, if not impossible. Gifting.
Now let's talk about gifting. Diane and Mario also tried to claim that the $147,000 was Diane's inheritance from her mother. She was just getting it early. To support their claim, they pointed to the $120,000 that Ricky had given Troy to enable him to purchase his business, saying, look how generous she is with her children. She gave $120,000 to Troy, so it makes sense she would give $147,000 to Diane. Justice Rob found this argument dubious, noting that if Ricky had given $120,000 to Troy and then $147,000 to Diane, not only would this leave very little to give to her third child, Denise, but it would also have left her without any secure accommodation. Ricky and Troy both gave evidence that the money to Troy was a loan, and it was always intended that he would repay it once his business was established. Currently, the business wasn't making enough profit to allow him to repay that loan. As proof it was a loan, Troy's share of the railway parade property, the $25,000, was kept by Ricky as part payment of Troy's debt. There was also a record of mechanical work that Troy had done for his mother, which was taken as payments of his debt, so that by the time of the hearing, he owed $89,000. The court was satisfied that the money given to Troy was a loan and not a gift.
Renovations. Diane and Mario tried to argue that Ricky was not entitled to be repaid the $18,314 she had contributed to renovating the property, because she hadn't paid rent or outgoings in the 3 years she had lived at the property. The court said that both sides made contributions to the other, as most people do in a cohabitation arrangement. It makes no sense to try to argue every contribution in a quid pro quo debate. Like, I let you live with me for 1 year rent-free and helped look after your three kids. Well, I paid all the outgoings and did most of the gardening. That kind of exchange wasn't going to help the matter. What would is to consider that the money Ricky contributed to renovations were likely to have increased the value of the property owned by Diane and Mario. While she wasn't getting the benefit of the renovations to the house, she should be refunded for her contribution.
And the winner is...
The court found that in not insisting to go on the title of the property, Ricky understood that Diane and Mario would be the true owners of the Casula property. However, this was coupled with an understanding that they would not exercise their rights as legal owners in a manner which went against the agreement with Ricky that she could live in the house for the rest of her life.
Justice Rob noted that, as so often is the case in asset for care arrangements, the parties had given little attention to formalising their arrangement legally, which could have saved them all a lot of hassle and possibly could have prevented these drawn-out legal proceedings. Documentary evidence showed that it was always the intention that the money Ricky provided was for the purpose of buying the property. Regardless of how Diane and Mario spent the money Ricky had transferred to them, the intention was that the money was to be used for the purpose of purchasing the property and they all knew that. This was even admitted by Mario in cross-examination. He was asked, "Were you aware or did you have any understanding that the reason why she was providing that money was because you had offered her a place to live?" Answer, "Yes, she felt, yes, that's right." Question, "And in return for having a place to live, is that correct?" Answer, "Well, she felt obligated to give something to us, yes." Just as Rob found that this, quote, "seems to be an acceptance by Mario that the payment and the opportunity for Mrs. Spinks to live in the new house were linked," end quote.
Just as Rob stated, there weren't only two options on the table, a gift on one hand or a loan on the other. Rather, it's possible that Ricky understood that when she transferred the money to Diane and Mario, she knew she couldn't demand it back whenever she wanted. But she did believe that she wouldn't need it because she would be living in the house with them for the rest of her life, and Denise would still get a share on her death. It wasn't an absolute gift, it was a conditional gift, and all the parties were aware of the conditions. The court looked at the laws relating to joint endeavours. Was there a joint endeavour here? The court found there was. The parties had made individual contributions to a collective venture, being the purchase and renovation of a house they could all live in together. Did the joint venture end without attributable blame? Although each side took the view that the other's conduct was responsible for the breakdown in the relationship, there was little evidence available, and the parties agreed that the agreement had ended prematurely and without attributable blame. Was there unconscionability? Yes, it would be unconscionable for Diane and Mario to get the benefit of full ownership of the house without having to account to Ricky for the money she had put in. Ricky believed that she could live at the Cazula property for the rest of her life, and the court found that she was justified in holding that belief because Diane and Mario's conduct supported it.
It was found that the money was not a gift. So what did this mean for Ricky?
Order's up.
If successful, Ricky was seeking one of two orders. Number one, her preference, was for the court to order that she was entitled to a share in the property proportionate to her financial contribution, and that Diane and Mario held her share on trust for her. Ricky's contribution to the purchase and the renovations was $168,314. Diane and Mario's contribution to the mortgage, stamp duty, and renovation cost was $455,000. This would give Ricky 27% and Diane and Mario 73%. The property had increased in value and was now worth about $800,000. This would mean that Ricky's share was now worth $216,000, about $50,000 more than she invested.
Number two, and second best, was to be refunded the money she had invested for both the purchase and the renovations with interest. She argued this on the basis that Diane and Mario had encouraged her to believe that she would live with them for the rest of her life. Because of this expectation, she provided them with money to purchase the Cazula property. She was also seeking more money because the value of the property had increased.
An interesting point, none of the parties were seeking to uphold the original agreement. The house was still there, Diane and Mario were still living in it, Ricky had given the money with the expectation that she could live there for the rest of her life. That could still happen, but none of the parties wanted that. They all recognised that it was no longer possible for the parties to live in close proximity. Which is sad, considering Ricky had once been so close with her daughter Diane and must have had a strong relationship with the grandchildren.
The court found that the parties had agreed that Ricky could live in the house for the rest of her life, and on her death, Diane was personally obliged to pay half of Ricky's contribution to the property to Denise. Justice Rob also found that Ricky understood that nothing would disturb Diane and Mario's ownership of the property, provided they complied with their obligation to let Ricky reside there indefinitely. Why am I mentioning this again? Well, because that answers the question of what orders to make. Ricky never had any expectation of owning a share in the house. She had agreed with her daughter that on her death, Diane would pay Denise half of the money Ricky had contributed to the purchase and the renovations, half of the $168,000 contribution. This would mean that Diane and Mario always expected to receive the benefit of any appreciation in the capital value of the Cazula property. For this reason, the court found that Ricky was not entitled to a 27% share in the property as it was valued at the time of the hearing, but she was entitled to be repaid her contribution plus interest.
She was entitled to be repaid the $140,000 she had contributed to the purchase, plus the $18,314 for renovations, plus interest. Diane and Mario were to pay Ricky's legal cost of the case. Appeal.
Subsequently, Diane and Mario appealed this decision. They challenged all of the primary judge's findings, but basically they argued that the primary judge had been wrong to find that the money wasn't a gift, and that he had also been wrong to count the money that hadn't actually been spent on the house. The appeal court dismissed the appeal and found that it was a conditional gift made with the intention that Ricky would reside in the property for the rest of her life. Such an intention was inconsistent with making an absolute gift. Looking at the facts, they noted that Ricky had been 62 years old, had just gotten out of an unsuccessful dress shop business, and had no other assets of significance. She would not have then placed herself in the position of financial vulnerability unless she had some firm expectation that she would have a home to live in. They also found that tracing the money from Ricky to the payments to the house wasn't needed. It was enough that her intention that it was for the purchase of the property was clear and that it was established that the money was a financial contribution to a shared living environment.
This is a bit of a segue, but I found it interesting that the appeal court used marriage as an example of a conditional gift. A gift given in contemplation of marriage is sometimes a conditional gift, meaning that if a person's fiancé gave them a gift, and the person then backs out of the wedding, they may be required to return the gift. But if the fiancé who gave the gift backs out of the wedding, they may lose the right to get their gift back. A bit off topic for our case, but I found that interesting. Let me know if you did as well. The appeal was dismissed, and Diane and Mario were ordered to pay Ricky's cost of the appeal. Lessons. There was one factor we didn't go into above, but I want to mention it now because it is one of the risks associated with asset for care arrangements. In this case, Ricky put money towards the purchase of the property, but the property was in Diane and Mario's name, and they had gotten a loan to pay the balance of the purchase price. Within 2 years, by 2015, they were actually in default of their mortgage over their Moorbank property. See, the plan was that when Diane and Mario moved into the Cazula property with Ricky, they would keep and rent out their Moorbank property. They would use the rent to pay off the mortgage. That didn't end up happening. Instead, Mario's parents moved into the Moorbank property and lived there rent-free. So they weren't getting rent that they could use to pay off their mortgage. Diane and Mario sold the Moorbank property in July 2015 for $475,000. Part of the proceeds were used to pay off Mario's $87,000 tax debt. Some of the proceeds were given to Mario's parents. None of the proceeds were used to pay off the loan on the Cazula property. What I'm trying to demonstrate is when legal title is in one party's name alone, they can mortgage the property and they can default on the mortgage. They may also have other financial debt that could ultimately result in bankruptcy or the sale of the house. So Ricky's unrecorded financial contribution and her undocumented right to stay in the house were put at risk by the legal owner's financial dealings. Even after they have sold their previous home, she had no power to force them to use the proceeds to pay off the mortgage of the home they lived in together. It's just one of the risks involved when the house is in someone else's name and you haven't got a written agreement regulating their financial dealings. Another key problem that we have discussed before is the faulty belief that several years down the track, you'll be able to remember exactly what you said and what the other party said, right down to the words they used. Did Mum say, "I would like to live with you and see my grandbabies every day. I also want to give you $147,000 because you care for me," end quote. Or did she say, "I would like to live with you and in exchange I'll look after the grandbabies and pay $147,000 and you will care for me when I get older," end quote. The exact words we use and the context make a huge difference, and remembering them is almost impossible. Justice Robb noted that, quote, "The recollections of all witnesses are prone to be fallible, particularly where the subject matter of the evidence is a matter of considerable self-interest to the witness, a substantial period of time has passed since the relevant events have occurred, and the witness has had time since the dispute arose to dwell upon the facts and the grievances that have arisen," end quote. So now it's time for Tanya's catchphrase, get it in writing. Don't just talk about it, write it down and create a record that may be invaluable in years to come. Another interesting thing, as it appears I could waffle on about this case forever, in a brief paragraph towards the end of the judgment, Justice Robb mentions an argument that hadn't been made in this case but could have been. The agreement was that Ricky would live in the house with Diane and Mario for the rest of her life. They didn't try to argue that the agreement couldn't be fulfilled because of Ricky's behaviour, but they could have. Let's say, just for example, this is totally made up, but let's just say that Ricky was a nightmare to live with. Imagine she smoked inside, left dirty dishes throughout the house, played the TV too loud in the middle of the night so it woke everyone up, and she yelled at everyone, including kids. Wouldn't you then say that she was responsible for the arrangement not working and should be responsible for that? That isn't what happened in this case, but it was an argument that could have been made, that the arrangement couldn't work because of Ricky's behaviour. For now, let's flip it the other way. In this case, Diane and Mario asked Ricky to leave. But let's say that didn't happen. Once again, just making things up here, but let's say that Ricky fell in love and wanted to move to Fiji with her new partner and demanded her money back. That wasn't the agreement. Diane and Mario were still willing to hold up their end of the bargain and let Ricky live with them for the rest of her life. Hell, they would even let her new partner move in. But let's say it was Ricky who was terminating the agreement and they could lose their house. Who would be to blame then? I would say that no one is necessarily to blame. However, you can't really make a lifetime commitment. You never know what's going to happen down the road. With asset for care arrangements as well, you can give it a go, but what happens if it doesn't suit you for whatever reason? That is why I strongly recommend that you discuss it in advance, you get legal assistance, and you draft an agreement that sets out what happens if the arrangement needs to end. Seriously, I can stand on this soapbox forever, but Therese, do you have any lessons for this case?
I have a couple of comments just very quickly. One point I think it's important to make that although this was in many ways a very tragic situation, the fact that Ricky's matter was able to be resolved by the courts was fortunate for her. The events resulted in her being so impoverished, she was in fact homeless and couch surfing, not great for a woman in her late 60s. But she was eligible for legal aid. Many people are not eligible, and their choice is either to be liable for legal fees and hope they're awarded costs, although they may not have all their costs covered, or enter into a conditional cost agreement, which is basically a no-win, no-fee. This, of course, carries risks for the legal team, but if they do win, they take a bigger share. All this needs to be weighed up against the time it takes to have matters heard and resolved, and the sheer emotional toll of being tied up in disputes, made even worse that it's with a family member that you were once very close with. This is burdensome for all parties, but I do feel the burden weighs far heavier on older parties, in particular parents. People shouldn't underestimate how harrowing these matters are for all involved, and the more you can do to avoid them, the better.
That was the case of Florenzo versus Spink, 2019. The case citations will be provided in the notes. If you don't know, we have a Facebook group. It is called the Growing Stronger Podcast Group. Look it up on Facebook. Feel free to join us. We share links to the episodes. We discuss the cases, and you can share your comments and questions, and we have a bit of fun as well. So again, it's called the Growing Stronger Podcast Group. I'll leave a link to the group in the episode notes. We're always happy to get feedback from listeners, so feel free to leave us a comment in the group. Feel free to join us as we create our own little elder law community. Thank you for joining us for this episode, and I hope you'll join us for our next episode of Growing Stronger.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power.